The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Scarcity is a kind of great equalizer. Researchers in the field of behavioral economics have found that whether it be less sleep, security, time, food, money, or whatever a person needs, scarcity hijacks the mind, diminishes intelligence, and lowers resistance to temptation. Harvard economist Sendil Mullahnazem and Eldar Shafir, professor of psychology and public affairs at Princeton, set out to find evidence for what happens to our minds when we have too little and what that does to shape our choices and behaviors. The result is their book, Scarcity: Why Having Too Little Means So Much. I spoke with Eldar Shafir when the book was first published. It's now available in paperback. You go through a lot of historic and contemporary research to reveal the psychology of people struggling to manage with less than they need. Less what?
Basically not having enough of whatever resource it is that you are lacking on. If you don't have enough time to do all the things you would like to do in your everyday life, you're having scarcity of time. If you don't have enough money to take care of the things that you consider, you know, essential for your everyday living, then you don't have enough money. Etc. Could be calories if you're dieting. It could be friends if you feel lonely.
We know that trauma actually changes the way that stimuli is received in the brain. Can the experience of scarcity change the brain, or is this just going on in the mind?
We, Sendil and I, do not do brain research directly. There is certainly evidence of chronic effects of trauma of living with poverty over years. In some sense, what we do is a little bit different. We look at the momentary effects. We can take somebody and make them poor in time or money, and within a very short time, what you find is that they now devote a lot of their attention to this area where they're feeling poor, where they're not having enough. You end up what we call tunneling. Everything else on the side turns into a kind of fuzzy periphery. We describe in a book a beautiful study where they looked at a school in New Haven where the train track was near one side of the school but pretty far from the other side, and they compare the performance of fifth graders who were randomly assigned to one side or the other. And the kids who are near the train tracks after 5 years at school are about 1 year behind in academic performance, which is, you know, a massive effect. The case we're making in the book is that, well, you don't have enough finances, or you're worried about rent or food or anything of that sort. It's like an internal train. It's like these trains going through your mind and interfering with your ability to manage, you know, the rest of your life calmly and well.
So this would, I can imagine, really reduce opportunity for somebody if their brain was doing other things, worrying, perseverating. But something else that you present in the book, an actual lack of imagination. People can't see themselves outside of this cycle.
You know, it's a part of the tunneling issue. As you're doing that, you're living a very, very focused life that neglects a lot of other things that would have been great to take advantage of, including things that could hurt you again, you know, worse tomorrow. So in some sense, we talk about a poverty trap. As you're neglecting things in the periphery, some come back to haunt you, you know, bills you forgot to pay, loans you took at interest rates that were, you know, excessively high, but to which you paid less attention as you're trying to solve a problem today. And all these things end up only making you poorer the next week.
As you pointed out, scarcity is sort of relative in many ways, not just a poverty trap, but for super, super busy people, there's a scarcity of time. Give us an example of how that might sort of spin out for them.
Well, I'm guessing a lot of your listeners will have had this experience where you're basically running around through a day where there's too much to do, and there's a deadline, you know, at the end of the day or the next morning, and there's just not enough time to attend and spend a lot of time focusing on your kids' homework or paying attention to your spouse's, you know, laments about something that happened to them that day. You're tunneling on the problem you have. You do much less well elsewhere. You might sleep less well because you're pulling an all-nighter to get the project done. the next day, there's data on this. When you've spent a night without sleep, you're just a little bit less smart and you do things less well. Very similar to the money issue with the poor.
How about the idea of tunneling for good? I mean, we recently interviewed a woman who wrote about Sherlock Holmes' kind of obsessive behavior in solving crimes. He kind of rides that obsession, that spinning wheel. Can it be used for good?
Well, it's a wonderful question, and it's a very important aspect of our work. If you look at how the poor manage their everyday funds, they do extremely well. They use their dollar. They manage the dollar much better than the rich. They buy things typically very, very carefully and wisely. They know how much they spent on a jar of tomato sauce as opposed to many of us who do not really notice it. They're managing things very well. They're kind of experts on the day-to-day juggle. But as they're juggling so well locally, again, they neglect things in the periphery, some of which are, you know, financially highly relevant to their lives. And so you find this in many places. You know, the students I see every day, when they pull an all-nighter, when they spend 8 hours a day, you know, they finally, after months, disconnect from email and disconnect from Facebook and just sit down and have only 8 hours left and write a paper, they're good at it. You know, many of us joke that what you see people do in college is not the best they can do, but the best they can do in the last moment. Mm. And, you know, they do very well. But the point is that as they've done very well throughout this night of pulling an all-nighter, everything else is neglected. They forget to call their mother on her birthday. They don't sleep as well. They eat less well. Everything else in the periphery is neglected. But again, as you point out, the act of focusing can lead you to very high performance at that moment, very locally.
We're speaking with Eldar Shafir. He is co-author of Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. Well, you write about some of the ways that public policymakers and health workers can accommodate or be sensitive to this tunneling and actually help build bandwidth. What are some examples of creating bandwidth?
Here's one way to think about it. We walk around with a very limited mental capacity, very limited bandwidth. We can only attend to a few things at a time. And that's kind of an interesting way to think about it, because what that means is that anytime you give me a little bit of bandwidth somewhere, a little bit of a bandwidth gift, I have more of it now to attend to other things. To the extent that you make my banking easier, more trustworthy, more automatic, more manageable, at that moment I can spend less time juggling my banking and I have more time to, you know, eat well or attend to my kids' homework or anything else I want to do in life. And so the intuition here is, what can policymakers do, especially for people who struggle with poverty? Poverty, in some sense, you know, we're talking about different sources of scarcity as if they're all the same, but in many ways, poverty is a more extreme case. You know, many of us who are very busy, you know, between us, don't tell anybody, you know, there's something we choose to do. We don't have to do it this way. I mean, many of us who are busy because we're trying to, you know, exercise and go to the opera and read a good book and do good work and do better work than the other people around us and stuff like that. And, you know, if we fail to do one of those things, at the end of the day, very often nothing much happens. When you're poor in money, it's a very different story. There, if you fail to pay the rent in time, you're evicted. If you fail to get food on time, you're hungry. It's a much more extreme version of it. Mm-hmm. And so the notion is, what can policymakers do to alleviate some of that juggling, tunneling that's required of the poor to manage their everyday lives? And paradoxically, what you find is that, you know, the less poor often get a lot more help than the poorer. So, you know, we get reminders and automatic deposits and overdraft coverage and friendly banking and all kinds of things, and lawyers and accountants and drivers and nannies and maids and all the kinds of things that help us manage our everyday lives. And basically, for a little bit of money, we get more time. When you look at the poor, the whole thing is much more complicated. It's very hard to get more money for your time. You can work another hour or two and sleep a little bit less, but that's not going to give you much. And you often get a lot less help. You have less reliable lawyers and less friendly banks and less good instruments that help you save for retirement in automatic and painless fashion and all the kinds of things that would make life a little bit easier. So the intuition is that if policymakers design a context where, for example, the poor can resort to short-term loans, with that going to payday lenders who charge an enormous amount of interest, if we simply made short-term loans available that are not too expensive, there's some evidence showing that would make the financial lives of the poor so much easier to manage, thereby liberating some bandwidth and allowing them to do other things in their lives a lot better.
Well, although the circumstances for the very poor are different than most middle-class Americans, there is a psychological state. You know, one of my friends calls it the disease of more. You know, there's never quite enough success or money or attention. Is scarcity a psychological state? And is that something that we can work our way out of?
Well, we certainly talk about it as a psychological state, as a sense of a feeling of not having enough. And whether you can work it out of it or not depends a bit on where you are. So, you know, I'm very reluctant to suggest that people who have a hard time finishing the month and feeding their children should work on having more modest tastes.
Mm.
It is certainly true that in many cases, you know, both, you know, the richer who feel like they don't have enough money or the very busy who just take on too much and could easily do with less, there it's certainly true that you could imagine, you know, very smart ways of making things better by just, you know, developing slightly more modest wants and needs. It's a deep issue because there's often a critique about work that's done on the American poor, saying, what do you mean they're poor? They all have, you know, TVs and
cell phones,
toasters and cars
up.
And what exactly. And that's sort of it's an interesting critique because it sounds sort of superficially like you got a point there, but it really is not very deep. And, you know, imagine I said to you, what do you mean they're poor? They all have running water. That just doesn't seem right. You know, things that used to be a luxury once now have become a basic feature of everyday American life. Yes, internet used to be an unimaginable luxury 20 years ago, but today, when it's a common staple and your kid at school basically needs internet access to do her homework, if you can't afford it, well, then yes, you're poor. And so in some deep way, there is a psychological element to it because as society changes its norms and its standards, what it means to be poor will change with them in the sense that there's certain things that you feel you ought to be able to afford and all of a sudden you can't.
Eldar Shafir, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Eldar Shafir, Princeton psychologist and co-author with The Economist, Sendhil Mullainathan, of Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much. There's a link to much more on the book and to Ideas 42. That's the nonprofit that they founded together to design behavioral economic solutions to social problems. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last October, we kicked off Good Gig, a series of conversations with individuals who've landed their dream job. Since then, we've talked to several people with interesting gigs, from a rare bookseller to a color expert, even to a fire repeller. And now we're going to play the conversation that inspired the series in the first place. Making a living as an artist can be tough, but Arthur Lean has managed to do it sketching courtroom proceedings. And like any aspiring law professional, he's worked his way up the ladder and is now sketch artist for the U.S. Supreme Court. He joined Word of Mouth to talk about his good gig, and I started by asking him how someone enters the business of courtroom sketching in the first place.
It is a kind of a dream job, and I pretty much just fell into it. Our governor in Maryland was going on trial, and I had just graduated from art school. And a local television station was looking for somebody, and that's how I got my start.
So you're normally hired by television stations or maybe newspapers?
Well, I've been doing this for a long time now, and since 1980, I've been under contract with NBC News in Washington, D.C. And recently, I started working for SCOTUS blog as well.
Mm-hmm. So how does one work one's way up to SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States, the pinnacle of courtroom dramas, I guess?
Well, actually, it's the first place I went to in D.C.
No kidding.
After that first trial and a couple other hearings in Baltimore, I wrote letters to the three networks. There were only three at the time. And CBS invited me to come and try out. And their artist at the time was a man named Howard Brody, who was a great, great sketch artist. He had been a war correspondent and, you know, sketched World War II and Korea. And he took me around, and he first took me to the Supreme Court, and then later that day to the U.S. Senate, which didn't have cameras at that time.
So how long ago was that?
That would have been in 77, mm-hmm. I believe.
So how about the timeline for turning these around? How quickly are you required to get these images ready for camera?
Well, you know, it used to be you just had nightly news to worry about. Now, of course, there's a 24-hour news cycle, so the joke is you go into the courtroom and take your seat, and before anything even has begun, the producer says, do you have anything we can shoot right now? You know. But I generally need about an hour and a half.
Wow. Sketch artists and stenographers, they were once courtroom staples, right? Now technology has certainly changed things for stenographers. Any notable changes in the way you do your work over the past couple of decades, besides churning it out for not just the nightly news?
Well, You know, I get these questions from young artists wanting to go into the field, mm-hmm. and I always tell them that it's a dying art, which it is. There are far fewer venues. You know, there's cameras in a lot of the courts. The Senate, of course, has cameras. And eventually the Supreme Court will have cameras. So my days are numbered.
Mm.
There's no stopping technology. And once Google Glasses become popular, I think that's going to be the end of it.
I recently interviewed Justice Sotomayor, who told me that she is really relieved because she was having her makeup done for the stage. And she thought, if I had to do this every day, look the best. Yeah, that would not be something she would be in favor of.
Well, when people ask my opinion about cameras in the Supreme Court, of course, whatever I say, they're going to say, well, this is a guy who, you know, has a financial interest in this.
Mm.
But looking at it from the point of view of one of the justices, I would definitely, think about it twice.
Well, what do you think you get in a sketch made over, you know, several minutes compared to a photograph that just gets one little glimpse and captures one moment in time?
Well, I think the sketch is more like a reporter writing a story. I get to condense things together. And I get to, you know, I have to edit some stuff out of it. So obviously there's a lot I miss, too, because, I'm trying to produce this drawing at the same time that, you know, things are happening in real time.
But obviously you're listening of what's going on, and I'm wondering about the actual decisions being handed down by the court. Do you think your feelings about a case or about somebody who's arguing a case has ever entered your work or has ever sort of influenced your work in any way?
I don't think so. I do try to capture what I see. You know, if I see a lot of emotion in a lawyer arguing before the court, I'm going to try and convey that. I really go out of my way not to put my own feelings into it. You know, I'm not going to make this lawyer ugly if I don't agree with his side, you know.
Twisting his mustache.
Right. And, you know, it's enough of a struggle just to try and get a passable likeness, you know, to get a gesture right or the position of the, you know, the way somebody holds themselves. It's very hard to listen to what's actually being said. And I don't think I'm as good at that as maybe some of my colleagues. I sort of get in the zone when I'm drawing, and I think my drawings are good because of that, but sometimes I miss what's going on.
We're speaking with Art Lean. He has the extremely rare and, as he says, disappearing job of a Supreme Court sketch artist. Are courtroom sketch artists tight-knit, or is there competition between the artists?
It depends. In Washington, D.C., we're pretty tight-knit. There are really just three of us right now, Dana Verkuterin, Bill Hennessy, and myself. From what I understand, the New York scene is very competitive. There are some artists trying to undercut others. And I think everybody up in New York is freelance. So it's sort of like whoever runs out of the courthouse with the sketches first sometimes gets the job.
I wonder about what's going on for you artistically. You said that you were an art student when you took this up. Is there any part of you that, you know, wants to experiment, wants to play around with things, or do you feel like, well, this is what is expected and this is what I have to deliver?
No, I play around a lot, and I change my media, probably every 10 years or so. Right now, a few years ago, just before the Sandusky trial, I switched over from markers to watercolor, and I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Oh, watercolor must be really interesting to work with in the courtroom.
It's great. It's great. And pencil. It's just so simple. And, one thing you have to bear in mind is sometimes I get sent out of town,
mm-hmm.
and you have to have use supplies that you could buy in any town, you know. So pencil and watercolor, that's pretty much universal.
So I know you don't only cover Supreme Court cases, but is there a particular justice that you like to sketch?
I would have to say Sotomayor.
Really?
Well, for one thing, she sits closest to the press section. And she also looks over in our direction all the time. Mm-hmm. We've often wondered about that, whether she's just turning her head so that she can hear better. But, you know, she's great to draw, and she's got these big earrings and, you know, bangles, and she's very active in questioning. So I think right now my favorite is Sotomayor.
Wondering about, for you, Art, any particularly memorable cases, you know, that are funny or surprising stories from your career that just stick out for you?
Oh, you know, there probably are. I'm going a little blank right now. I'll say the toughest case I ever covered was the McVeigh trial.
Oh, you did that.
Yeah, and we did a nightly news story every single night. It was really, really stressful.
I mean, obviously, it was a pretty fraught case, but I'm wondering what made it so difficult out of all of them for you.
You know, the pressure and the testimony was just awful. And it just was sort of unrelenting. And the pace, it actually moved along very quickly. You know, I just found that on the weekends, you know, by Sunday evening, I was just starting to feel normal again, you know. What was also strange was, I think, McVeigh's, the way each day he would come into the courtroom with a big smile and, you know, sort of like, it just was a very, very strange juxtaposition, seeing the victims there and McVeigh, who just seemed to think that he had done a great thing, you know.
So that's a pretty grim picture. Any trials in particular that stick out for just giving you a lot of hope that justice will be done?
Boy, there haven't been very many of those. I guess, you know, a lot of the abscam trials were pretty amusing.
So you got to draw the guy who in the movie Christian Bale played with a comb over?
You know, I haven't seen that movie yet, but I believe what's his name, Weinberg?
Yes.
I believe I did. Yeah, somewhere I have those sketches, and I need to dig them up.
Well, what an archive you must have.
Well, yeah, I have a huge archive, and I'm in the process of trying to put everything online in an archive. So I have a lot of scanning to do, and hopefully I'll get it done.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Courtroom sketch artist for NBC and also now for SCOTUS blog Art Lean. You can see examples of his work and find a link to his website at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Whether it's a leaky ceiling, a washing machine on the fritz, or windshield wiper blades that don't seem to last a season, at some point you may have wistfully said to yourself, they just don't build things like they used to. Are things built to last anymore? Were they ever? This next story from 99% Invisible tackles those very questions. Here's Roman Mars with more.
Steve Burrows is a principal at an engineering consulting company called AirUp.
I'm Steve Burrows, CBE, and I'm a professional engineer.
And when he saw the Great Pyramid in Egypt for the first time, he reacted pretty much the way I imagine most people react.
When you actually go and see something that's somewhere in the region of 40 stories high, that was built 4,000 years ago, you know, you just have this incredible wow moment.
But then that structural engineer brain kicks in.
Every time you look at something, you think, first of all, how did they do that? Then I start thinking, how would I do that?
And in a recent article in Design Intelligence, he took those questions head on, as if a client gave him a brief to build something like the Great Pyramid today.
We get these incredible challenges where you're doing something that's never been done before. So one of the incredible facts for me was that the Great Pyramid stood as the tallest building in the world for centuries.
And as someone who, in the present day, is hired to engineer seemingly impossible structures, Steve Burrows thinks that the engineers of 2600 BC really knew what was possible and made most of the major decisions as a present-day engineer would.
So some of the things they knew were that if they built on the Giza Plateau, they could put stones that to a certain pressure and the ground didn't collapse beneath it.
You can look at other pyramids and see the previous mistakes that were made.
And they got to know what the ground capacity was. And I think that determined the size of the Great Pyramid.
Because if you're going to build the tallest building in the world, how tall do you want it to be?
Do you want it to be a mile or just a bit taller than the last tallest building?
You've got to make a decision.
And I think the decision was made for them by the quality of the ground that they were building on.
So that was number one.
Secondly, they had to build it in the pharaoh's lifetime. And I'm pretty sure that somebody, you know, a contractor said, you know, with the best will in the world, we can only lay this number of stones a day, and I can only assemble this many men.
And assembling men seems to be the right wording here, because, and I totally missed this historical revision, but the consensus now is that it was a rather privileged, well-treated class of Egyptians that built the pyramids, not slaves. That blew my mind. Cecil B. DeMille is going to be pissed.
20,000 men can only lay this many stones a day, and the pharaoh typically lives 35 years. So, you know, that many men times that many stones times 35 years means it's going to be this high.
So the ground can only hold so much mass without buckling. The workers can only build so much in a pharaoh's lifetime. And finally, the material had to be delivered to the site in time to build the thing.
And I would think, depending where the quarry was relative to the actual site, which was chosen for its known ground bearing capacity and also height and visibility above Cairo, they also figured out that they could only get so many stones there. They only had so much material of the quality at the quarry.
So Steve Burrows thinks that these practical engineering considerations determine the size of the pyramid, its height, the number of stones, and ultimately what we all marvel at thousands of years later.
It wasn't so much mystique as just practical necessity.
Another practical consideration that led to the pyramid's longevity is material chemistry. There are other ancient buildings that have not held up as well as the pyramids.
The buildings I saw had lasted thousands of years, and they hadn't all performed perfectly well. So it was pretty clear to me that the Egyptians had a pretty good understanding of the material they were working with, but it wasn't 100% perfect. For example, the first large mud brick structures that I looked at had massive vertical cracks in them. And it was very clear to me that they were thermal cracks. What had happened is that they were used to building walls, but when a wall turns a corner, that point becomes very stiff. And because the temperatures vary hugely between day and night, these materials, these walls, expand and contract. And when it contracts, masonry will always break next to the stiff point. So every time there was a corner, I found a huge vertical crack. So they clearly didn't understand the thermal performance of mud bricks.
And that problem is exacerbated by the fact that they laid these mud bricks on a mortar bed. So they effectively have two materials for building.
So they'd used mud brick and mortar. And by putting these different materials together, they thermally move at different amounts and they had cracked.
So somebody must have said, well, if we'd only use one material, laid the bricks dry, would they have performed better? And the answer is yes.
And the pyramids are exactly that. So there is only one material that's used. That means that the pyramids, you know, they get very hot in the day and very cold at night.
But the material throughout the pyramid is consistent.
And so it didn't crack. Because they moved together, they effectively breathe. And because they breathe to account for the changes in temperature, they're able to last a long time without cracking and breaking up.
So this prompted Burrows to think about modern buildings, where we put so many materials together all the time.
Steel and glass and aluminium and concrete and cementitious materials and plasterboard. And I started walking around modern buildings and looking at where all the cracks were. And every crack is at the joint between different materials. And I started to think, maybe we could think about this a little bit more. And if we did, we could actually make buildings last longer, just by thinking harder about those joints, which presently we solve by putting, you know, gooey material in the joint to try and take up that thermal movement. But if we just detail them better in the first place, they would last longer. And I think, you know, the longer buildings last, the more sustainable they are. So the longer their life and the less materials we use in the long run.
Longevity is probably the most basic route to sustainability, and the pyramids are the poster children for longevity.
You know, there's an old Arab saying, man fears time, but time fears the pyramids.
In addition to chemistry, adhering to basic principles of physics keeps your building around for millennia with little or no maintenance. A pyramid is a nice, stable shape.
And I think they will have learned that.
But it isn't as simple as the way I was thinking about it.
If they had a bucket of sand and they poured it on the floor, then it actually naturally makes a pyramid shape. So intuitively, they know that that is a stable thing to do. But actually, one of the interesting things is that the gradient of the sides of the pyramid is not determined like sand by its natural angle of repose. You can actually make it whatever you want to make it. But you can see from the prior pyramids, from the step pyramid and the bent pyramid, the pyramids that preceded the Great Pyramid, that they were sort of going a little bit steeper, but they never really got above 50 degrees. Because I think somebody felt that there's a sort of a maximum angle about which we should never exceed.
So again, empirically derived knowledge sets the agenda.
If you put these things together, how much stone you can get, the bearing pressure that you can put on the ground, and the angle, you know, it determines the height of the building. And I'm pretty sure the simple mathematics and the work between the architect, engineer, and contractor gave a practical limit to what could be built.
This exercise in using engineering principles to augment the archaeological data may give us some insight into why the Great Pyramid is both the oldest and the largest pyramid of Giza. Because people probably thought it was the limit of everything. It's the biggest bearing capacity, it's as steep as they could go, and it's as many stones as can be laid in a lifetime. You can't do any bigger than that.
You know, it's the speed of light, if you like, for building pyramids.
I know it's no revelation that the pyramids are well designed, I'm not an idiot, but learning about these practical considerations from Steve Brose just made me appreciate their majesty in a new way. These structures are not otherworldly. You don't need to come up with crazy theories to explain them. They are the product of smart architects and designers and engineers and skilled workers who applied knowledge that was gained over time and passed down over generations. And through that perfectly understandable and repeatable process, they discovered their limit. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't ever want to see the tallest building we could possibly build, but I might like to see the one designed with enough durability and flexibility to last for 4,000 years.
And that story came to us from producer Roman Mars and 99% Invisible.